That's one of the best introductions I've ever had. Yeah. I'm Otto Kinchin, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And because this program works in my life one day at a time, I haven't had a drink of anything containing alcohol or a mood-changing chemical since the 22nd of June, 1968. And for that, I'm grateful. And I don't say that to impress you, and I don't really care what impression you get of that, but it impresses the hell out of me because it's the best I've ever done in my life. I want to thank you for inviting me to come to Tulsa and share my experience, strength, and hope. If I say anything that steps on anybody's toes, why, you know, and you get hot, you'll just have to get over it the best way you can because I'm leaving as soon as I get through, and you can talk to the speakers committee. In the event of say anything you like, well, I'll take time to listen to that, you know. But I am delighted to be here. Mason called me, and I knew in the back of my mind there's something going on this weekend. And I told him I'd call him back the next morning. I checked my calendar, and there's nothing there. And I called him, and I am grateful to be asked to come somewhere to share whatever it is that I've got in Alcoholics Anonymous. And about 3 weeks ago, I snapped that this weekend is when my sponsor has their round robin in Odessa, and it's kind of necessary that I be out there and listen every year at that thing. So my group, and I belong to the Big Book group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Norman, Oklahoma today, and I think it's the best group in the country, and I invite you to come and see us. We have meetings every night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Friday night we have a late meeting. We have a Saturday night open speakers meeting and a Sunday morning meeting. So, and we're 301 East Main. We're right on Main Street, and there ain't no way you can keep from finding us if you're in our area. We invite you to come by there and spend some time with us. And anyhow, you know, I got my deal kind of screwed up, and I got a split and gone to Odessa, but my group went on out there this morning, and I'm a little envious of them. But I feel good to be here and to see a lot of my old friends and to make some new ones. You know, if you came here tonight to hear any great profundities, you're going to be, you're going to be out of luck. Now, if you'd heard me 10 years ago or 5 years ago, well, I could have had an answer to any of your problems before you told me what your problem is. And, you know, today, I really know what I don't know. And ain't nothing, you know, it's just there. I know that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. It works in my life. And it's the best deal that I've ever had going. And, you know, if I'd have planned my life from the time that I surrendered to AA over 12 years ago, I'd have cheated myself. Because I've gotten so much more than I ever dreamed be humanly possible. So much more. Just ain't no way that a cat can get to where I'm at tonight from where I started from. You know, I don't know when I took my first drink. I don't know when I became alcoholic. I spent a lot of time trying to figure that deal out. And I've come to the conclusion just don't make any difference. You know, I am, and I'm aware of it today. It's been, you know, I've come to some conclusions based on facts since I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've seen that there are two types of alcoholics around AA. There is one bunch of people that were instant alcoholics. My wife, by her own admissions, the first time she ever took a drink, she got drunk. And got drunk every time she drank. And that didn't happen to me when I first started drinking. You know, but somewhere along the line, you know, I got into the compulsive alcoholic drinking. And I don't know when it happened. I had a lot of fun for a number of years drinking. I did not experience blackouts from the very first when I started drinking. And I only mention this, that if there's somebody out there, you know, that's in the place that I was in when I came to AA, that you're not alone. And you know, the longer I stay around this deal, the more I know that I'm not different. You know, and God, that's a great relief to find out that I'm really not different. You know, it's an amazing thing. In our group in Norman, we have... and I lied just a little bit about our membership, but about 50 people. And half of them are under 21 years old. And, you know, a lot of people say, What do y'all do? We treat them people, them young folks and old ones, just like drunks. You know, and the stock answer for our young people, if somebody says, I spilled more than you drank, they just tell them, if you'd have drank more and not spilled quite so much, you might have got here sooner. About half of us in that group are chronologically older. And I used to get my jaws tight. We'd go somewhere and they'd say, that bunch of young folks down Norman. Finally, I snapped one day, hell, they're referring to me as young, see? And now I kind of dig it. So, you know, it's really all right. And, you know, I was thinking tonight, oh, Wayne. Of course, Wayne automatically reminds me of my first sponsor, who was a full-blood Osage Indian. Buttermilk, I know, knew him. And probably some more of you people can, I'm sure, knew him. A lot of you people knew him. Ace Oberly, he's dead and gone now, and may soul rest in peace. And Ace used to tell the story, and Wayne kind of reminded me of the story. You know, Ace had talked about the drunk that's fishing down on the creek, and he run out of bait, and he wanted to fish some more. And all he had was some moonshine whiskey, and he's sitting there wondering what he's going to use for bait, and the snake came by and had a frog in his mouth. So he caught that snake, and he took the frog away from him. And then he got to feeling bad about cheating the frog out of his food, so he just gave that snake a drink and throwed it back in the creek, and he tore that frog up and went on fishing. And about 15 minutes, he felt something hitting him in the back, and he turned around, and that snake had another frog, you know. That's kind of the way alcohol did me. Yeah, really did. I don't believe that it's of any benefit to me to tell you all anything about stealing or, you know, using dope or smoking dope or anything. I don't think that you need to know an awful lot about that. Probably you know as much as I do. It's and I'm kind of hesitant to say this because every time I hear an old boy say, I ain't going to tell you no drunk log, you better buckle up because he's going to take you on about an hour trip. But I'm going to get through it just quick as I can. I think that, for me, that it's sure necessary that I remember from where I came. And my book tells me that I am to tell generally what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And, of course, to me, the most important part of this is how I'm living sober. And when I'm with you, I want to know what you're doing in sobriety. And, you know, I believe that, you know, that sobriety is abstinence of all mind-altering chemicals. Yeah. And I know we got a little controversy about this around AA. Years ago, 12 years ago, dope fiends wasn't looked on too good in AA. My sponsor was not a dope fiend. He didn't know anything about narcotics. And we came to a realization, and I did particularly, that I found a singular answer for a dual problem. And when I speak of you about alcoholism, you know, I'm talking about all them deals. Now, I don't care if you eat them pills and lick your nose and claim you're sober, I'll not be jingling your telephone for any advice on how to live sober. Now, that's the way I feel about that end. I had... I had a dude call me not long ago, long distance. He said, Otto, a friend of yours told me to call you, and I need to know how to stop smoking marijuana. And I said, have you got a pencil and a paper? And he said, no. And I said, get you one. So he rustled him up the pencil and some paper. And I said, now, I want you to write this down because it's pretty complicated. I said, in order to stop smoking marijuana, you've got to stop smoking marijuana. You know? And he said, you son of a bitch. I wait. And really, that's what they told me about, you know, about getting sober. Well, you know, if you want to get sober, the first thing you've got to do is stop drinking. You know, a lot of people miss that. Hell, I see them come. I see them come to AA for a long time. You know, say, man, I just can't get this program. And hell, they just forget to quit drinking. You know, and I think that's a prerequisite for the deal to work. I'll tell you how it works when you don't. You know, in the early 60s, my wife and mother told me I was crazy for so long that I'd begin bleeding. And I went to a psychiatrist. And after an hour's consultation with that cat, he said, you're not crazy. And I said, what's wrong with me? He said, you got a drinking problem. And I said, what'll do about it? He said, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, that man told me that that due to my nature, that I had to get involved in this thing if it was going to work for me. And so I left, and I, at that time, lived in Apache, Oklahoma. A lot of you know about Apache. It's, if you haven't been there, you just haven't lived. Well, you know, 1,500 folks in Apache. Always been 1,500 population. Seemed like every time a baby's born, somebody leaves town. It just never changed, 1,500. Yeah. And one of the greatest entertainments there is going uptown, sitting on the street and watch streetlight burn out. You know, not lots like that. But I love Apache, really do. And if it's my choice, I'd probably be living there today. But I was living there, and I went to Lawton, and I found an AA group in Lawton. And I finally got up enough nerve, and I went in there, and I saw some people that I knew in the business world. And, you know, I wanted 10 years of sobriety the first 30 minutes I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just wasn't willing to go to any length. You know, I don't know how many meetings I went to. I don't know how long I stayed there. But I do know that a guy told me one day, he said, you don't have to go to the meetings. And I said, what do I do about my drinking? And he said, why? He said, I'm taking that antabuse. And I said, where do you get it? And he told me at the doctor. And I went to my doctor and asked him for a script for antabuse. And he told me to, you know, that I needed to stay sober for a couple of weeks and come back. And if I did, that he'd give me the antabuse. And some way I stayed sober for a couple of weeks and went back. And he gave me the antabuse. And he told me about the side effects, sluggishness and headaches. And I'm hip to the pep pills already. The next morning I was sluggish and had a headache. And I went by the seam. And I was off on a rat race. And for the next year, I didn't drink anything containing alcohol. I eat every pill that was on the market. I smoked some of that non-habit-forming marijuana. And I shot me some of that dope, but I didn't drink anything containing alcohol. And, you know, in AA, I'd heard people talk about being in jails and penitentiaries and mental institutions. And I hadn't been in any of these things. I'd been arrested, you know, on a drunk charge a few times, but nothing really serious. Well, I'm here to tell you that if you haven't experienced these things, and you be alcoholic like I am, and you got to go out there and do some more experimenting, by God, it'll happen, and I'll give you a guarantee of that. You know, and it wasn't too long after, well, in that next year, I'm telling you, if I had a God at that time, it was money. And I wanted money more than anything in this world. And I wasn't so naive as to think that I could do the things that I was going to do and go untouched, but I thought I was willing to pay the price. And I thought I could muster me X amount of dollars. I'd buy my social standing, buy my friends, and everything would be all right. And I was willing to pay the price. I just turned Jesse James, and I stole anything I wanted at any time from anybody. It just didn't make no difference. And, you know, if you couldn't take it, just lay down and claim it. And I got to lots of jails, and I started to where I might identify some of them folks. And, you know, I usually kept me a lawyer, an old bondsman, you know, sitting on ready to get me on the streets where I could get my business together. And every now and then I'd get, they just never would. You know, one thing I just laugh about today, I hear one of them lawyers saying somebody stiffed them for a fee. You know, I never could get one of them lawyers done track without laying the green down first, you know. So it kind of tickles me today to see one of them get stiff. And I had a bad thing about lawyers until I got to AA, and my sponsor today is a lawyer. You know, kind of show you how the program kind of unveils and works. And I, you know, I really do. I have a lot of good friends that are attorneys today, and I say this in jest. But at that time, I really had a thing about it. Now, once in a while, I'd have to call my mother and my wife to get me out of jail and get me on the streets. And I can shorten it down considerably. I was over at Perry, Oklahoma, and I sold a treasury agent a large quantity of marijuana back in the early 60s, and they just throwed me under that Oklahoma County Jail. And, you know, throwed the keys away. And, boy, I was in the worst trap I've ever been in my life. My mother at that time gave me the greatest gift she's ever given me. She came to that Oklahoma County Jail and she told me, she said, son, you have busted yourself. And you're going to bust me if I stay with you, and I ain't going down with you. And you're just going to have to do whatever you're going to have to do. You know, and I love you, but that's the deal. And she walked off and left me in a jailhouse. And I didn't understand it for a number of years. Greatest gift the lady ever gave me was to make me be responsible and accountable for my own actions. You know, she can't give my brother that gift today. I've got a brother that's been trying to stay sober trying to stay drunk for 12 years, and I've been trying to stay sober. 5 years ago, I told my brother that, as far as I was concerned, he didn't exist anymore. And if he ever got sober and wanted to live sober, that he's welcome in my house or to anything I got. But as long as he's trying to stay drunk, didn't want to see him, and he wasn't welcome in my house, and we ain't seen each other. I went to a Goonie Roost to see him here a while back. He was out there drying out, and I went to see him and spent about 15 minutes with him, and he got out of there, and he's back out there doing it again. And my mother can't give him the gift she gave me. You know, he spends about three-fourths of his time at her house either getting drunk or getting sober. And, you know, it just tears my heart out, but that's the way the deal goes. It's been my observation that those that are the closest to us, we can help the least. You know, it's a weird thing. Lots of paradoxes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went on to the penitentiary, and I went to penitentiary with 2 7-year sentences and 2 3-year sentences running wild with no parole. I was locked up about somewhere 6 months, and they reconstructed my sentences, and I had to do 7 years without a parole. And, you know, the lady that I was married to at that time, I told her before I went to join, I said, you know, we had a small son, and I said, you better get a divorce and start you a new life, and if I ever get my deal together, well, we'll meet somewhere down the road. And that lady chose to wait for me while I was incarcerated, and for this I'll be eternally grateful. I went on to penitentiary, and I didn't learn nothing in the penitentiary, really, that I like to remember, although I learned some things. I learned to live one day at a time. I learned to make do with just whatever was available. You know, and I finally surrendered. And every time that I read what in the front of our book, in the doctor's opinion, and, you know, about the total ego deflation, I really know that it just takes whatever it takes to get us. And, you know, for me, it took that road to degradation, the humiliation and everything else to deflate me, to totally deflate my ego, to get me in a position to where I was teachable. Now, in 1967, they changed the narcotics laws, and I was granted the privilege of going for a parole. I went before a parole judge January the 15th, 1967. They gave me a parole, set it off till June the 15th, and by now they'd moved him from Terre Haute, Indiana, to maximum security joint where I was at for a couple of years, down to Texarkana. I wound up over in Segerville outside of Dallas. For 6 months, I had the privilege of working downtown Dallas during the day and going back to penitentiary at night. And, you know, as I look back over my life, it is a turning place in my life. For the first time in my adult life, when I was working with them old square people at Aeromotive Engineering and out in Brook Hollow there in Dallas, you know, I didn't have to pretend. Everybody knew I was a convict. They knew I was a dope peddler. And they didn't know I was a drunk. That's the only thing they didn't know about me. And, you know, they accepted me for just whatever it was. And, you know, I realized for the first time in my adult life that people could like me for just what it was. And if you're new or you're old in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're having trouble and you're still hiding behind that facade of pretense, if you want it to get better, you know, you'll let her drop down and just be you. And it's a great deal. You know, it's been one of the greatest learning experiences that I've ever had. And I just don't have to impress you no more. You know, and somewhere in that other book, that other big book, I think the carpenter said something about, for ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You know, it's really been the truth in my life. And funny thing, you know, I couldn't get a job. So from a little old parole plan, my mother drummed me up a little job in laundry. And I couldn't get a parole advisor, and there's a banker owed me a favor, and I called him one day and I said, you're going to be my advisor? And he said, I ain't, I'll get you one. And he found a little old preacher that didn't know me, and he agreed to accept me. A lot of you know Andy down at Apache. And after Andy agreed to accept me, they said, the old thing's incorrigible. You can't help him. Good luck. And it is under those conditions that I was to go back to Apache. Now, I had seen my wife in 42 months. I'd seen her 3 times. And that was by my own request. And she was trying to take care of our son. She wasn't on welfare, scuffling, making a living. And she didn't need to spend that money to come see me. And, you know, it is because I didn't want her to that she didn't come see me. But we hadn't had anything going for a long time anyhow. And right before I was to be paroled, they called me into the personnel office at Aeromotive Engineering, and they said, Otto, we'd like you to stay and become a permanent part of our staff. And that is the greatest thing that had ever happened to me in my life. And they said, we'll give you a substantial increase in salary. We like your work. We like you. We'd like for you to be a part of our deal. And I just floated back out the penitentiary that night. I was higher on the natural than I ever had been on anything. I drank, smoked, eat, or shot, or anything else, you know. And I got out there, and my caseworker was just delighted, and he called the Justice Department. They sent a Twix back the next morning and said, if that cat goes on parole, he goes to Apache, Oklahoma. He doesn't have any business in Dallas, Texas. And I left there that morning, and I was the most dejected, despondent son of a bitch you've ever seen. And there was one old boy that I hadn't used up, and he picked me up. And in 15 minutes, I'd throwed them penitentiary clothes away, and we was getting it on. And I never remember leaving Dallas. I come to in the Holiday Inn in Norman, Oklahoma. And I don't know how I got there. I don't know whether I paid that bill or didn't. You know, and I walked from there, and I finally got home. And I ain't ever got honest enough, never will be, to go back and ask them if I paid that bill. I just split, you know. And I'd never drank in Norman. I'd never been, to my knowledge, never been in Norman before. And never went back for a long time. And I went to Apache. And my son was the only person in Apache that spoke to me because he wanted to. And for the next year and a week, I had me just a siege of hell. You know, I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had in the back of my mind the thought that I, someday, some way, I might be able to drink again. And I tried her and tried her and tried her. And I fought as hard as I could for a year and a week, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I surrendered. And boy, I tell you, when I came, there wasn't no doubts. I conceded to my most innermost self that I was powerless over alcohol and all them other deals. And I came and I surrendered, and the only reason I surrendered is because I knew that I was going back to penitentiary if I continued to live the way I was living. I walked in the door, and there's some folks down there, and, you know, the first time around AA, they just loved me and come down here loving me to death. And when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, 22nd day of June, 1968, old boy told me, he said, dummy, you leave your head outside and we're going to thank for you for a spell. And I had me about six, seven of them self-appointed sponsors. I ain't asked none of them for nothing. You know, and I'd say, you know, in my opinion, they said, shut up. Hell, I come to Tulsa and spoke before they'd let me say anything in my home group. The only valid way that I can give this thing away is the way I got it. And baby, I love them dudes today for showing me some tough love and telling me just exactly, you know, what to do and when to do it. And they said, you know, you're going to meetings. And, you know, I have people today ask me, how long you got to go to meetings? And I just tell them till you want to. And, you know, that's the way it works. You get that in there tomorrow. And, you know, they told me, they said, you know, if you want what we got, you got to be willing to go to any lengths. And you'll do everything that you're told to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you got to give it away if you're going to keep it. Now, this Indian fella, you know, that kind of gathered me up, he's the only one that's nice to me. And Asa was a beautiful man. Now, Asa and I ain't got nothing in common. He's one of them bay rum drinkers and one of them Skid Row Indians. And, you know, I'll lay them checks down and steal, and I'm a Chevis drinker and a high roller, you know. Men that Indian ain't got nothing in common. You know, I hear people today say, well, I just can't identify with them because, you know, we haven't lived the same way. And I think, you know, that's a bunch of bull as far as I'm concerned. You know, because on my own experience, Asa shared some things with me. See, I believe very strongly that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not believing in God. You know, and I'd mumble it and drop my head when I'd say God. You know, and some of these dudes told me, they said, Cap, if you don't believe, that don't bother us a bit. You just fake it till you make it. You've lied about everything else all your life anyhow. So, you know, lie to yourself about this God. Pretend there is one. And if you're sitting out there tonight and the word God bothers you and you're having a little hassle with it, you know, I tell you, if you want to get better, just fake it. Just believe there is one. And, you know, I'm an odds player. And the way I figured the deal out, I looked around AA and everybody that believed in God was doing better than I was doing. They was wearing better clothes. They was driving a better car. They had more money in their pocket. And they had a twinkle in their eye. So I just thought her out. I decided, well, if they're on a rib, it might be better to believe that there is a God and let them hit me in the face with that shovel when I croak and find out there ain't one than to believe there isn't one, let them hit me in the face with that shovel and find out there is one. So if there's anybody that's got any hassle about it, you know, it's proven to me. And the book tells me that some of us came to scoff and remained afraid. And that literally happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know when it happened or anything. You know, I don't know nothing about it. No angels ever flew down and zonked me and give me one of them deals. You know, very slowly I've gotten mine. I think they refer to it as the garden variety in our book. You know, that's really what happened to me. And old Asa take me places. You know, of course, Mitch, and a lot of y'all know Mitch. See, Mitch is a guy that he and I formed, were the founders of the Apache group. Now, Mitch come by get me, and I never will forget one February. God, it was snowing outside, and we got 20 miles to drive. And he come up there, and he said, get your clothes on. I said, oh, man, we ain't going tonight. He said, yeah, we're going. And he is bigger, you know, a lot more bigger than I am physically, and I knew he was going. So I told him, you know, we need a shovel and chains and sand. Oh, I got it all taken care of. And we go out there and get in his old pickup, and we go to meetings. Now, we get to Lawton, and them people at Lawton, it was too bad for them to come to the meeting, but we went to the meeting. And I tell you this because they told me that it's all right to miss a meeting if you dine. And other than that, there ain't no excuse for missing a meeting. And that's the way it happened for me. Now, Asa never wore a watch, never looked at a road map. He called me one day, he said, early on in my sobriety, and he said, we're going, this like on Monday, he said, we're going to take a Friday night meeting to Odessa, Texas. And I said, where's Odessa? How far is it? He said, I don't know. I said, when we leave? He said, I don't know. Figure it out and call me. And, you know, if Indians don't talk much on phones, you know, have some conversation. So, and he just hangs up, you know, and I get the map, and I look, and hell, it's 375 miles to Odessa. I call him back and I say, hey, man, we're going to have to leave 10 o'clock in the, you know, on Friday morning. He said, okay, pick me up. And he hangs the phone up. And so 10 o'clock Friday morning, I pick him up. And we boogie for Odessa. And we get out there, you know, big folks met us, kind of like tonight. And we had a nice feed and visited with them a tad. And Asa let me have about 5 minutes of his time at the podium that night. Greatest thing that ever happened. You know, and we got through at the meeting, and they had a room for us, and he said, oh, we're going home. And we're getting old car and going back home. I'm home time to go to work next morning, you know. And that's the way I broke into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know how far is too far that you go through a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still don't know. You know, 2 weeks ago, Big John Carlton and Bill O'Neill, you know, they don't care for me breaking their anonymity. And they called me in the middle of the week, and they said, you bring Lisa, a young lady that belongs, a member of our group, got a whale of a program. You bring Lisa and another lady, and you be in Brownwood, Texas, 6 o'clock on Saturday night. And they hung up, you know, and I told Lisa and picked out another girl, so y'all be ready. We've got to be in Brownwood, 6 o'clock Saturday night. They said, well, what's the details about all this? I said, I don't know. Listen real carefully, and I'll tell you everything they told me. They said, you bring Lisa, one other one, be here at 6 o'clock Saturday night. And I said, that's all I know. So, you know, we boogie on down there and have a hell of a meeting, come on home, you know. It ain't too far, 300 miles, something like that. That's just all there is to it. Funny thing about it, you know, I call them and ask them to come, and I don't have to give them all the, you know, the particulars. And it, you know, it does my heart good to be able to call somebody and they come to our group and support us and share their experience with me. I think that's part of the deal for me. Whatever you think is your business, you know. I just know that the things that I have gotten as a result of doing some things that I don't want to do have been, you know, just out of this world, indescribable. And, you know, I wasn't sober a year, and Asa called me, he was in the hospital, and they was to be released the next day. And he said, Otto, I was supposed to help this man celebrate his birthday in Wichita Falls, and I can't get out of the hospital till morning. Will you go down there and substitute for me? And God, this greatest thing that he had, you know, that I'd ever been asked to do. And I went to Wichita Falls, and I made one of the greatest AA talks you have ever heard. And I come home, and I just knew it. And I wanted to call Asa, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. So 7 o'clock next morning, I called the hospital to tell Asa what a good job I'd done. And Asa died during the night. And, you know, boy, I just couldn't hardly handle that deal. This old man had got him in a lot to me. You know, and I looked to him for strength. And zoom. And I thought, God, why are you doing this to me? I was asked to be a pallbearer at his funeral. There were 3 of us, white men and 3 Indians. First time in our part of the country, a white man had ever been a pallbearer at a funeral. Greatest things in the world. You know, I knew sitting in that funeral that day that Asa would always be with me. Wouldn't ever have to look for him again. He's here tonight. Yeah, he's with me all the time. I learned and experienced there. I had never been able to look at death. I wouldn't go to funerals, wouldn't go to hospitals, wouldn't meet, you know, just wouldn't think about it. Been to a lot of funerals since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a different deal for me. You know, it's just another growing experience. My next sponsor was with a man from San Angelo, Texas, Hoot Gibson, another great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hell of a dude. Just had more wisdom than, you know, than anybody that I've ever met. Didn't have no education, but he sure had a lot of wisdom. I used to go see Hoot or call him, you know, I'd have some trauma, and he'd say, don't worry about it. And I'd think, the old fool just ain't smart enough to have this deal figured out, and he's buying him some time. You know, and I'm here to tell you today that I know what he is talking about. You know, just don't worry about it. 99 times out of 100, when I get into a problem, if I will give it a good letting alone, keep it from being an obsession, you know, it'll resolve itself, or I will intuitively know what to do. You know, it just works. The book tells us that. You know, Hoot gave me lots of things. I spent lots and lots of time with the man. And Hoot also died. Hoot died on me long in 73, 74. I don't remember the time. And it was a great loss, but, you know, I was all right, because through Asa, through Hoot, you know, they pushed me away from them. They taught me to stand on my own feet. They taught me to, you know, to get in communication with the God of my understanding, where the strength all comes from anyhow. You know, and it's all right. Now I go to my next sponsor, Roy, and I ask Roy to be my sponsor. Roy says, 2 of them died on me. You know. You know, I have lawyers think anyhow, you know. He said, I'm going to have to take this man under consideration for a while. But, you know, Roy and I have had, it's been a tremendous relationship. You know, my sponsor, I hope someday to be able to present the program about, to live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous the way that I see he lives it. See, I believe that in choosing a sponsor, you need to find one that is apparently living the program the way you'd like to do it, and then go turn yourself into them. Now, for me, when I take a sponsor and ask a man to be my sponsor, I give him the privilege of getting in any area of my life that he sees fit. And it's just that simple. And I got to do it. I got to totally surrender. I don't ever have but one sponsor at a time. I don't sponsor people that have two or three sponsors. Because if they're like I am, if I've got three sponsors, I will play every one of them against the other one, and then I will take the easier, softer way of the three. And that's the reason that I don't believe in having but one sponsor. Now, if you believe in having you a bunch of them, that's fine with me. I don't care what you do. And the only thing that I'm sharing with you is what I do. And, you know, that's just the way it is with me. And my sponsor and I have been through lots of things together. And it's grown into a relationship that, you know, I really love my sponsor. I love him as a man. You know, and I can say that without any homosexual tendencies to it. You know, don't bother me a bit. And I can hug my sponsor. I can kiss him if I want to. You know, I think he's the greatest man that I've really ever seen. Because I've seen, you know, I've seen him walk through lots of problems in sobriety. And I've seen him conduct himself with dignity. Hopefully that's what I can achieve in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that I have achieved some. Buttermilk can tell you anything that's happened to me had to be good because I didn't have no way to go but up. I was at the bottom of this deal. But all the things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me, you got to surrender, Cap. And I have more to surrender today than I did over 12 years ago. I surrender more each day, you know, and it's all right. It ain't simple. My life, it ain't ever going to be a bed of roses. You know, I don't know nothing about that tiptoeing through the tulips. You know, it's been my observation. I know about me and observation of other people that alcoholics know an awful lot about operating under pressure. You know. And when I'm under pressure, you know, I can function. I sober a few years and got some pressure off of me, and I was riding down the road one day, and I had some money in my pocket, and I had my bills paid, and nowhere to be and for two or three days. And this first time since I'd been sober that I was in this shape. And the first thing run through my mind was, I believe I'll park this old car and get me a plane, go to Vegas and get me some of the dancing girls and some of the nectar of the grape, you know, and celebrate a little bit. And another thought run right on behind my mind, boy, you dummy. You know, the first time that you get out from under pressure and the first thing you think of is screwing up. You know, and I got an AA meeting just fast as I could, and I hung out with AA people. And, you know, that's what my people have told me to do. My people have told me that they're the one thing, intensive work with another alcoholic, is the greatest insurance against taking a drink. You know, and I believe it, and I've done it consistently over the years. You know, I was sober 3.5 years, and this lady that had waited for me while I was in penitentiary, she and I were divorced. And you know, I give her a pretty good screwing on the settlement, whatever little we had gathered up in that length of time. And I went to Dallas, and I divorced that woman because I was trying to find out, you know, I was trying to find me. And I went down there, and I stayed 6 months, and I wasn't involved with anybody. And I truly was doing some searching. And in 6 months, there's a guy that I really didn't like, but he gave me a solution to my problem. And he told me, he said, what you got to do is that you got to get out of your problem and then you'll know what to do. There ain't nobody can tell you. But if you block it out of your mind, eventually you will rise above the problem and you will know the solution. I'm sitting in a meeting on a Sunday morning in Dallas. I'd been there about 6 months. And a guy talked about wanting life on his terms, wanting sobriety on his terms. And, you know, it dawned on me immediately that in that marriage that I had wanted everything on my terms, my way. You know, I'm so bad that if the speed limit's 30 miles an hour, I'll drive 35. I just want everything my way. You know, I'll roll them stop signs. I'm very bad about not following directions. Don't want nobody to tell me nothing. And I knew what I had to do if I could get it done. So I went back to Apache, and I went to that lady, and I told her, I said, you know, I would like to try this marriage again if you want to, and I'll expect nothing in return. And the only thing that I tried for the next 3.5 years was to be a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a better father, and a better husband. And I made a vow to my God that if I ever left there, it would come from him that I'd never leave of my own volition. If I was supposed to stay there forever, one day at a time, I'd just do it, expecting nothing whatsoever in return. And as a result of many coincidences, and I believe today that a coincidence is where God remains anonymous, I knew 3.5 years later that I was free to go. And I knew it without any doubts. And I divorced that lady, and when we divorced, I was totally willing to lose everything I had, didn't want to, but I was willing to up everything. And I didn't have to up everything. And the thing that liked to kill me was my son, at that time, was the only human being that I've ever loved. The only human being. And she took my son and took him out of state, and I was not allowed to see him. And the court says I got partial custody of him, you know, and that he's to be with me at certain times, and it ain't happening. And there's a judge, lady judge, and I was talking to her, and I said, I ain't paying him child support. I'd been paying him about a year, and she wouldn't let me see him. And I said, I ain't paying it. I'm going to force her back into court, and I'm going to make her do what the court says she's going to do before I pay her any more child support. The judge said, you'll pay your child support. And I give her a cussing. She said, not because we make you, but because you can't live with yourself if you don't. You know, I went on home, paid my child support, and went on about my business. And you know, a year later, due to some more coincidences, my son and I, in fact, you know, the coincidence was that I was invited to share in an AA function up in Canada. And while I was up there, I'm in auction business today, I'm an auctioneer. While I was up there, there's an old boy asked me, he said, would you come back to Canada and sell a sale for me? And I said, I don't hustle AA people, because them dudes, when I come to AA, told me, you can't hustle AA people. I sell them sewing machines. And they say, you can't sell no AA people sewing machines. And so I never kept it. And if somebody asked me, I'd go to them, and they'd give me their okay, and I could sell it. So I never hustled AA people, you know, because I'm bad. If I ever started hustling, I hustle you all the time. But I told this dude, I said, you call me when I get home. I can't talk business at an AA deal. And I come home, he called me, and we made a deal. And I was going back up into North Battleford, Canada to sell an equipment auction. And I called my son, and I told him that I'd like for him to go on this trip with me. And, you know, his mom couldn't refuse him that trip. And, you know, as a result of doing whatever it is that I'm supposed to do, you know, she had to let the boy go with me. And today we've got a beautiful rapport. And, you know, she and I don't talk much. We're civil to one another. I really don't have any resentments to the lady. I know she's a good woman, she is a good mother, and she's done a lot of good things. And I know that the pain that I put on her, and the scars so deep that they don't heal. And I know that. And I have no guilt, but I also have no resentments against the lady, because, you know, she'd done a lot better than I'd do if I'd been in her shoes. But my son and I do get along pretty good. You know, and years ago, I was up in Wyoming, and I'd got a gal pregnant and married her in that order, and I went after a loaf of bread and never did go back. And she had a son, and I've never seen that boy. And through the years, when I was drinking, I used to catch flame, get to Denver, Casper, and I never did get all the way to see that boy, so I've never seen him even today. And when I got sober, it bothered me a lot, you know, and I used to rationalize, because she was from an affluent family, she didn't need my child support or my money, and everything is all right. And I rationalized that when I was drinking. After I got sober, I was paying a price for the deal. And when I got into the 8th step, you know, and started making some amends, I wrote a letter one night to she and this child and tried to explain to them what was wrong with me and what I was trying to do about it. And usually I mail them letters after I write one of them, read it, if it's okay, just mail it and get it out of the way. And this night I didn't do it, and I was in a motel working on a deal. And I laid it on the dresser, and next morning I got up, and after my morning meditation, I read that letter again, and I knew instantly that I had no right to mail that letter. I just had to be willing, you know, to make the amends. I had no right to enter these people's lives at this time. They hadn't seen me in over 20 years. And I just had no right. And I threw the letter away, and I felt okay about it. Two or three years later, the child's grandmother was through our town, and she told the lady that works for me, she said, you know, John would like to know something about his dad. So my son and I were coming out of Canada, and I told my boy, I said, you want to go see your half-brother? Yeah, he game for anything, you know. So we come down through Wyoming, and I called this lady, and I told her that Van and I were passing through her town and that I'd like to stop and see John, and she said no. And I said, well, your mother had been there and had stopped at Apache and had told me that John had wanted to know something about me and would like to get acquainted, and that's the reason that I've called. She said, you're not welcome. And some way I was able, with some dignity, to say, fine. And, you know, we get back in the car and boogie on. And I just got to remain willing to do whatever it is I got to do. You know, my program tells me that they ain't everybody going to accept these amends. I don't know. I hear some folks say they go make some monetary amends, and people say, oh, just because you're sober, you're just so great, you don't owe me nothing. You know, everyone I've gone to, they say, why in hell didn't you pay it sooner? You know. I ain't ever felt good about going and giving some old boy money for that check and say, here's what old hot check will give you. Thank you for sending me to jail. You know, I felt good about the actions. And I had one deal that I swore I never would clean up. I owed the phone company $600 and something when I went to penitentiary. And I come out of the joint, and I made a vow. And I told them, sponsor told everybody in AA, never pay them. They've charged it off, and they got a monopoly, and they don't need it. Got all the money in the world, don't need my $600. Ain't ever paying it. My sponsor at that time told me, well, if it ever gets bothering you, you might have to pay it. Don't worry about it. And I got me a telephone. They said I couldn't get one. I got one. Got me a credit card. Everything going along smooth. One day it became necessary for me to pay the phone bill. Because of me, inside me. Now I go to my sponsor and I tell him, well, I got to pay the phone bill. He said, okay. He said, here's the way we're going to do it. Now, you're going to pay him $50 down. And see, I was ready to high roll and just go plunk it down and get it out of the way. And he said, we ain't going to do this another way. You're going to pay it $50 down, and then you're going to make it in monthly payments of $15 a month until you liquidate. By now, I've progressed a little in this world, and I've got a lady that takes care of paying the bills, writing the check. And he said, Rosie ain't writing this check. You're going to write the check, and you're going to put it in the envelope, and you're going to put it in the mailbox. And you'll do that. And I died every month when I had to write that $15 check. Mail that son of a bitch, and I was never so glad in all my life when I got one of them wiped out. And I can report to you tonight that I got her done. You know, I got that slate cleaned up. And I beg of you, you know, if you knew an AA, don't say you ain't going to. Everything that I've ever said that I wasn't going to do, I've had to do. You know, just say, I don't think I'll do it. See, that'll give you a little out. Well, I tell you, it is tough. It's tough. I believe that the ninth step, that the actions that I take in making my restitutions, you know, in here is the deal. It ain't how you receive it. Mine have not been received well, but it's been good, you know, and it just ain't ever made me feel good, but it has made me feel good, and that's the paradox in the deal. You know, my son today, as a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I had the power to draw on a board and write down what I wanted out of a boy, I would not change one thing about my son. My boy has never given me one second's trouble. You know, he's all boy. He drank a little beer and smoked a little weed, chased some gals, you know, and that's all right. But he has never caused me one moment's problem. I took him with me when he was young, when he was 5 years old, four and a half, 5 years old. I taught the boy how to work. The last 2 years of his high school, he held down a full-time job and got a scholastic academic scholarship to the university, you know. And he graduated from high school this year. He's a good-looking kid, you know, and he's a very sensitive boy and a sensible boy. You know, and I created this thing, and I always told him, I'll buy you a new car when you graduate from high school. So last Christmas he called me and said, I'm going to give you a break and let you buy that now instead of in May. And I said, of course he wanted a pickup, you know. I said, the deal is that if you give me a break, you'll take this pickup I've got or you'll wait till May. I said, I don't want yours. And he said, I'll wait. So about 3 months later I called him. And he said, I hope you ain't mad at me. And I said, well, what's the deal? He said, why should it be? He said, I bought me a pickup. I said, okay. He said, I got her financed okay, and I can make my payments. So I said, fine, I'll take the money that I was going to spend on the pickup for you for school. How much are you going to need? And he said, I don't need any. I've made my own arrangements for that, you know. And God, I just choked up, you know, and I thought, you know, he won't take anything from me. You know, and then I got to thinking, Lord, you know, this is the thing that I'm striving for. I'm trying to make the boy self-sufficient, you know, and independent, and he's independent, and I can't handle it too well. Of course, I can report to you tonight he's broke down a little bit, and I think he'll take a little money along the way, you know, to help him. But, you know, the kid is a good kid, and he's a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he's been lots of AA meetings. He knows AA people. And you know, if I didn't get nothing but that out of the deal, it'd be more than I deserve. It'd just be more than I deserve. You know, May the 22nd, 1975, as a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, President Ford issued an executive order and gave me a total and complete pardon and reinstated all my rights as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A little town that I was raised up in, that I come back to from the penitentiary, you know, totally beaten. I can today walk through the streets of that little old town with my head up and in dignity as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I could stand here from now to doomsday and tell you all of these great things that have happened to me as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm going to tell you something. The pain that I've experienced, I believe, are the touch steps, the touchstones to growth. You know, the seemingly bad things that have happened in my life have helped me to develop some character. The good things are good, but the pain is the thing that has made me grow. I have never been laying by the pool, basking in the sun, sipping on that lemonade, and decide to work on a character defect. I don't know. I get up to my ass in alligators and somebody's about to drain that pond is when I go to work. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. You know, I believe that my sobriety is a gift from God. And I believe what I do with my sobriety is my gift back to God. And I hope that He's as delighted with His gift as I am mine. Thank you.